Yeah, what do you guys think overall? What's your if you had to rate it out of 10, what's your rating?
I don't know, man. I think I needed to settle in. I think all these books I need to settle in, like look back in a year and kind of rate them. What do you reckon, Rich?
Hard to assign number scale. I was thinking about this too because Phoebe asked, like, what are your top five books this year? And it's like not obvious to me. Like, Jest is obvious, but then something like Brothers K or this book, I don't actually know because got a lot out of it. But I don't know if I'd
This
like,
one?
yeah, but I don't know if I'd like full-throatedly recommend it to a friend or whatever. I think it worked really well in this environment, but I don't know if you wouldn't like read it as a beach read or something. So
Yeah, sure.
it's like a, I think it's a
Yeah, I'm
really
not
good
sure.
book though. My vibe check this week was basically, what the fuck? We got a third act murder mystery out of nowhere. Like,
Yeah.
not how it's done. Like, what are you
It's
doing?
similar to Brothers
Completely different.
K in some sense, right? Where the murder actually doesn't happen until later on in the book.
Yeah,
Like,
but
through the
I mean,
mystery.
this one
Brothers
you didn't.
K,
The Brothers K opens
they're
page one
hinting
that there's
about
going to
it.
be a murder.
Like, that's
Yeah.
true. You know,
Like,
that's
this is what it's
true. That's
about.
true.
This one's about the map
It
and the
comes out
territory
of
versus
nowhere.
like capitalism art critique.
Yeah,
And then, like,
that's
suddenly
crazy.
it like ends and it's like this murder mystery.
It's so like it's annoying to introduce a whole new cast of characters and suddenly become a police procedural.
That's so fascinating. Yeah.
But at first I found that like pretty discontinuous, and I was annoyed because like I felt we were onto something last week of being like, oh, this is what the book is about. Like, these are the critiques and it, and then like Jed doesn't even feature in it so much. But after I thought about it more and reflected on it, I feel more continuity from the third part to the first two.
I mean,
And
as
I
you
think it's a
finished
pretty
last week,
fucking
you're
good
like,
book.
let's talk about death.
Yeah, and that's it, right?
Lucky we
Like,
saved it.
yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So it was
That's why we
hinting
didn't
at.
want to listen to you last week. Yeah, I mean, it was
Thanks, man.
yeah,
Yeah,
no worries.
that's so thoughtful. That's why you kept doing tangents constantly every time I tried to bring it up. Yes.
I usually stay off them.
It's not because of your undiagnosed
self-diagnosed.
ADHD.
Yeah, I mean, I found this third. I was surprised you guys weren't reading it. I found it went by pretty quick. I suppose you guys are busy, but like, it went by pretty quickly because it's a murder mystery. And then I wasn't sure if it's like how much does it say about me? It's all suddenly reading quite quickly, reading a murder mystery quite quickly, and then like all these other books are like fucking struggling, including this one. Yeah, it moved quite quickly. I think it was, I wanted to. Yeah, what's it about murder mysteries? I suppose it's just literally because it's a mystery. Yeah. I wanted to find out about it, and it was kind of revealed before it was finished, right? Like halfway through this act, and then it kind of
Yeah.
meditated on some other stuff.
And not even an interesting resolution to the mystery, although we can talk about that later, but
Yeah,
yeah, like introducing
no,
another
definitely.
character that you hadn't heard of
It
that actually
didn't
done
feel
everything was interesting.
satisfying.
Benny, vibe check.
Yeah, I think my sense is I'm probably at the point, Rich, you were at a couple days
Give me
ago,
2 seconds, I'll
feeling
come
that
back.
the first two parts and the third part are somewhat discontinuous aside from the theme of death, I suppose. I'm having a hard time grasping the themes of the book, I think. Like, I'm having a hard time figuring out what I'm supposed to think about it, I think. Like, there seems like a lot of micro parts of the novel that you could zoom in on and talk about that, but holistically, it's unclear to me. It's still very mysterious to me. What even the ma I know, like, we kind of put our finger on one of the major themes maybe last week, but I'm not fully convinced by my own thesis there. And I'm even less convinced because of the last part. And there's just a lot of choice, like, a lot of choices he made that I'm unsure about. Like, what was the point of having the murder be super gruesome and for the murderer to be someone who we hadn't seen before? Like, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to take away from those kind of from those kind
What
of
was that, sir?
facts that I wouldn't have just gotten from his dad dying, for instance, right? It was supposed to be like a meditation on death in some way. His dad's death seemed much more significant to the plot and to the earlier themes than Ulbeck's death. So yeah, I think in general I'm just a little bit confused about how to think about Ulbeck's death and like what was going on there and what he was actually trying to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You do that?
It seems fractal in some sense, the book. Like there's just all these different things going on. You could zoom in on lots of different themes. It's unclear to me how everything kind of comes together.
Yeah.
And a lot of stuff went
I'm not
unresolved, right? Like
sure
him
what's
and
fractal.
Olga was kind of unresolved.
Yeah. I
Like
think part
just
of
the
it, it's the
general.
point of it. Like, we're used to trying to boil it down into bullet point takeaways of the message is this, this, and this. But I think this book is like partly it's ambitious, so it's saying it's talking about many things at once, and it's okay if there's not like one overarching theme that touches everything. But also, it feels to me more like a feeling or a vibe or a evocation of some kind of like primal fear than it does an actual factual message about capitalism or whatever. Like, it's evoking something.
Yeah, I wonder to what extent this is just his perspective on life. Like this is like his sort of just meditation on the major themes of life and dealing with loneliness and all these kind of things. And it's just kind of him not word vomiting, but just sort of like writing a book about all the kind of things he deals with and just leaving it at that sort of thing.
Your loneliness did stick out. And then there's this question of how true was Welbeck to himself as the character, but I mean, he definitely was described as lonely. Like no one knew him, right? That's why they couldn't solve the thing. He's got like one. It sounds like he's got one friend who didn't even know him that well.
Takes a lot of guts to write about yourself like that in the third person, I think. It's very interesting, right? Like when the police are describing, like, wow, this guy had no close friends, not much going on in his life, no visitors, wasn't doing anything interesting with his time. Like, it's sort of impressive that an author can write about themselves like that.
Yeah, maybe if we knew him better, we'd know how much he was like winking at the audience and stuff with some of these descriptions of when he described like even early on, he like describes when he's introducing the Welbeck character, he describes him as like misanthropic and stuff like that. Yeah, or it's just his attempt at modeling himself.
So there's an epigraph at the start from an old French guy that is, the world is weary of me and I am weary of it. And I think that is pretty much encapsulates the vibe of this book is like resignation and yearning for some bygone era, whether it's your own youth, your, sexual dynamism that you once had, purity of something, purity of industry or commerce that's been corrupted, purity of nature been corrupted. It's a real bummer because no one gets what they want in this book, but not even in a way that they learn something or they attain some higher thing that they didn't realize they actually wanted. It's just like everyone's ambitions get thwarted and everyone is just sort of captured by like entropic forces or something.
Oh, sure.
So like Helene has lost her faith in economics having any validity. And she thinks that like kids these days are too dumb and they're not even worth teaching. Welbeck has no
That was funny.
friends, no intimates. He has like six people in his address book and he just wants to be left alone. And he even is denied that, right? He basically wants to like rot in peace and he instead is murdered
Good one.
in a grisly way. Inspector Yaseline retires before he can solve the case. And he's also impotent, which is like very obvious sexual decline type energy. And he's not even that bothered about that, but his dog is also impotent and he's quite upset about like his dog not being able
Yeah, that's
to
so funny.
carry on the line. Franz, who must be mega rich, is like a drunk and is not the wealth is not sitting well with him. Olga doesn't get Jed. Jean-Pierre, his creative work is stymied, and he basically works for the man and then kills, well, you know, gets euthanized. Who else? Like,
what
I
about
think,
Jed? I mean, Jed's the main one who gets rich, right? But but also feels lonely. And but yeah, what would you say about Jed to fit in this? I think you're right with everything you said so far.
I don't know if Jed is a counterexample, but he doesn't fit the pattern quite as clearly because it still feels like he is living out his true artistic vision where he says, like, I just want to, I can't remember what he says. I just want to represent, I just want to make an accurate or faithful representation.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it is sort of noteworthy that he ends up misanthropic. He ends up with virtually no friends, no lover. But he carries,
also, he definitely thinks
do you reckon
his
he's
dad
a misanthropic?
Woke.
Sorry, Benny, you go.
Well, I mean, he definitely lost in terms of he didn't want his dad to go to Switzerland, right?
True. Yeah.
Like he fought pretty hard with that, which happened. And now he's kind of had both parents.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the big bummer feeling that you get from this book is basically just everyone coming up against the fact that it's you can't reverse entropy or something like that. And not even fighting it, but just like accepting it with better or worse grace and being resigned to it. And it feels like a book written by an old man. They're bitter about the way things have gone, but they know they don't even care about trying to be inspirational or trying to change it or whatever. They're just like coming to terms with it and trying to portray the world as it is, even if it's not a cheerful portrayal.
Yeah, no, I think that's a nice take on the book. To be slightly autistic about the claim that around entropy is, I mean, one aspect about reality is that we can kind of, it's extremely hard to, but we can kind of fight entropy, to be Deutschian about it, but with creating knowledge. That said, it is like this incessant phenomenon that we're always fighting and comes for us without knowledge. Yeah, no, I like that take on the book. I hadn't really thought about that.
That's nice.
Yeah, I think you get like the reason I started thinking about it is in that the epigraph and then the very last scene where it's describing his video montages. And the final scene is quite literally a portrayal of like industrial objects, like, you know, keyboards and microchips and stuff, which are being corroded by sulfuric acid. And it's transposed on top of it as grass growing or a return to nature or something like that. And ultimately, the industrial stuff is completely destroyed and returns to sort of the before times, which seems like a representation of entropy, right? That we can create like little patches of negative entropy, but then ultimately that is a short-term thing. I don't think he's thinking about it in those terms. I don't think he would necessarily use those words, but that's more like the vibe. And it's also the reason why my like critique of this book and the thing that doesn't sit well with me is like, from a Deutschian perspective, I don't agree with this portrayal that I empathize
with.
It's
not impossible to fight.
Yeah. Like nostalgia for the past, loss of innocence, like being scared of death, losing your sexual drive and aging and being controlled by like optimization processes that are completely alien to your world and to humanity. That's all extremely resonant with me. But I don't like the idea that we just face it all with grim resignation, because I think there are potential answers to all of those problems.
I wonder about all of them. I know Deutsch inscribes problems are solvable in the rock, but like certainly like building houses and building society, you know, you sort of fight entropy. But like a lot of like personal stuff of like, well, I suppose that's what agent technology is trying to do. Yeah, so even then, like people can fight it. On a personal level, it's hard for you to fight it. You can kind of try and slow entropy. It's like, you know, you lift weights and you you exercise, but like at the end of the day, like it sort of comes for you unless new discoveries are made.
So do you think so the stuff we talked about last week about Jed, like creativity versus these optimization processes and it being corrupted by those sorts of things, do you view that in the same lens as being like creativity is in some sense trying to reduce entropy locally? And there's a lot of people who just get caught up in is the analogy that the optimization process and entropy are in some sense similar and push people towards sort of similar ends.
Does the optimization process, the incentives that push us away from creativity to instead scale and stuff like that?
Yeah, stuff like that. And like most people give into that. Jed for a while was able to fight it. Artistically, he was able to fight it, but personally, it seems like he wasn't.
On that, I'm not sure if I'm missing a point, but around like the complaint of scaling things up as the incentive rather than new discoveries. Like, I kind of want to like, sure, scaling up's good because, you know, you add a lot of good to the world. But it also it gives you room to be creative, right? I suppose maybe if all you're personally doing is scaling up and maybe all everyone's doing is scaling up, it doesn't. But yeah, part of me thought
it's not just the scale thing, though. I think it's more just like all of the perverse incentives of capitalism that are not aligned with the good. So it's not like a simple trade-off of scale versus new things.
Yeah, so it's just trying to be concrete around like what are all those things that aren't aligned. I suppose I'm a little bit more sympathetic to capitalism than Welbeck. And like, I know externalities and all that, sure. And maybe that's just the point.
There's all that classical stuff, but like there's heaps of concrete examples in here as well. Like, for instance, you can death is for sale and commodified for 5,000 euros a pop.
So like erodes the roaring trade. Soul.
Yeah. Mm. But, buy a very expensive nursing home, which still won't give you any actual satisfaction. So you still can't even buy the thing that you actually want. Like Jed's father is miserable until the end, even when he's living in opulence, he still kills himself. But he can buy
it's a little bit Wallacean in that sense, of like we surround ourselves by pleasure and luxury, and then there's these sacred things that connecting with humans and other stuff that don't get satiated.
Yeah. So it's capitalism's not only failure to solve some of the main problems of human existence, it's that it also creates markets and things that are corrosive to the soul and exploitative from cradle to grave, right? Where they're like, oh, it costs $20 to buy the sodium pentatol or whatever it's called to kill someone, and they charge 5,000, and they've got like revolving door of like coffin, like these crappy plywood coffins just like coming straight out the door, and they do the most cursory examination. And yeah, so it's
funny. I share the instinct that corroding sacred values feels we should at least be chested and fancy about it, and it just feels wrong. But there are other examples where I think like sacredness is the issue sometimes. Like the conflict in Israel Palestine, you know, like part of that conflict is the land sacred to both parties. And
hold on, I'm just gonna make a mark for editing.
No, I won't get into the rights and wrongs of the war, but part of the problem is the sacredness of it, and like if people were less sacred about it, or like another thing, like let's say you had concerns of long-term global warming, and like do people in a low-lying island in the Pacific, are they going to lose their homes? And like in one sense, so well, you know, you could give them money and they could just move to New Zealand, Australia, and then like, but then you like lose this sacred sort of homeland, and refuse to leave or refuse for it to be possible. And it's like, well, if they're less sacred about it, you could kind of solve that problem. And reducing sacredness sometimes is a good thing. But on the flip side, I do sort of share that, like commoditizing sex and love and family and goals that you want to achieve, isn't necessarily good, and it's like anti-human as well.
Yeah, to be clear, like, I'm obviously a big fan of capitalism, at least in the sense of nothing is better than it, and, you know, I'm not really that interested in litigating, like, exactly whether each of Welbeck's criticisms is true, but I just think that's what he's going for, and I think it's, like, directionally correct, if not on every specific case. If, like, I'd have to think really hard about, like, exactly the policy settings for euthanasia. I actually think euthanasia is a good thing, but maybe it should only be run by the state, not for profit, that kind of thing.
Sometimes I see an argument, it's almost like there's a status quo bias of, like, we have these sacred values and, like, we don't want to lose them, and it's kind of circular. It's like, because they're sacred, that's why, and if they weren't sacred, that wasn't why. I think I've heard, like, Ayla or Ella talk around sex work and stuff and the stigmatization, and she talks about, you know, some people bring up the criticism, they're like, a lot of girls, you'd be an OnlyFans when you're like 17, and like, you're very likely going to regret that shit when you're kids, or even when you're 25, and it's like, don't fucking do it. And like, they don't quite get the Pandora's box, or, you know, the ring of Sauron. It's like, just the level of it when you're so young. So yeah, porn's bad for boys, but at least, like, you're not like gonna potentially ruin your life in one decision. And her point is, like, but if you stripped away, I mean, the stigmatization of society is, like, built in there. And if you somehow manage to strip all that away, then, like, do the costs go? And I think it's a fair point and hard to grapple with. And it's similar.
It's a theoretic thing, right? It's still good advice to any given individual.
Yes, yeah, and I think she'd concede that, and then she'd say, well, the higher level thing is, like, maybe you push back against stigmatization, so then it's kind of like the whole argument of, like, would it be better to be, like, a sexual minority around proclivities and stuff, and then, like, it might be bad, it may be worse off, like, I'd rather my kid not be there, because it's going to be worse off, and then you say, well, if it wasn't stigmatization, then, like, it should be fine. But to go back to our examples, like, or our sacred, you know, like, selling the kidneys online and stuff, like, you lose this kind of sacred human value. But, like, if we just weren't sacred about it, it would be fine. And you get this kind of circular thing of, like, fuck it, well, I just want to keep being sacred about it, because that's, like, what it means to be human. And that was strip away everything. And then, but then you kind of, it's almost like you're at deadlock, and you kind of have this other person argument. It's like, well, it just be better if you stripped all that away, and we were all commoditizing everything, and everyone's better off. But
you're not at a deadlock, really. You just have to do good criticism and argumentation about, like, it's like the Chesterton's fence thing, right? You gotta, why does that tradition exist? Why is that thing considered sacred? Once you fully understand why and can articulate why, then you can decide, oh, we can move on without this, and, you know, we can now have full civil rights for blacks, or we can let gay people.
I suppose it's hard sometimes, because a lot of these things are a bit more illegible, and they're like stuff like religious and traditions that have this, like, implicit knowledge.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, Chesterton's offense, they must be around, they must be doing something. And actually, I'm going on a slight tangent, but I just listened to Benny Ewart Vaden's podcast recently about anti-rational and rational memes, and rational memes solving problems, and then anti-rational memes stopping criticism, and that's how they spread. But, like, I think it's also important, like, a lot of anti-rational memes do solve problems, and they're maybe kind of they have a rational meme element to it. Like, so there's something like religion is probably solving a problem for societies and for people, and it's also got this repercussion mechanism where it disables criticism. And as you guys pointed out, anti-rational memes aren't necessarily bad. It might be a good thing that we have religion. It just has this additional mechanism. But, like, yeah, so religion's probably solving problems in society, and stripping society from it is potentially one of its gravest mistakes. I'm not sure about it, but, like, we've done the experiment, and we'll find out. We're fucked around. But, like, it's kind of hard to know, because it's, like, this is all kind of this implicit knowledge, illegible stuff, and then you kind of find out after. And even after it, it's kind of hard to causally point to, like, all of it and say it is the problem. But yeah, it's just one of the hard things about some of these sacred. I think Robin Hanson says a lot of sacred stuff we is in the far mode, in terms of near mode, far mode, and far mode it's kind of harder to see and analyze.
I mean, a lot of Ulbeck's themes, though, I think are, most people would agree, they're sort of objectively good things that are being corroded by these sort of entropic processes. So something like creativity and doing what you love, right? I don't think many people would say that those are, I think we can articulate why those sort of sacred values are just good in and of themselves. I don't think they have this circular element of just being good because they're sacred and sacred because they're good. Whereas,
well, I don't think every sacred thing has that. Something just, like sometimes it's hard to make the case for them. Carry on.
Yeah, but I'm saying, like, yeah, but the point is, a lot of these themes, I don't think it's that hard to make the case, right? So, like, you know, following what you're actually interested in instead of the money seems like objectively good. Same with like family and stuff like that. The stuff Jed's struggling with, relationships and family, also seem good. We don't have a hard reason articulating why those kind of things are sacred and why having them be corrupted is a bad thing.
But I'll drop this, but like I could imagine some nerdy, less wrong type arguing, well, this feeling that we have are obliged to people that share our DNA is understandable for evolutionary reasons, but it's kind of arbitrary, and like we shouldn't need that, and we'd be better off if you could kind of relinquish that feeling. And like, who cares if like you don't see your family at all? Like you guys, I share that it's kind of like this horrendous thing, but like, I also can see the argument against it. Creativity is a bit harder to argue against. But anyway.
Yeah, it almost doesn't matter, the argument about if you could shift everyone all at once into a new equilibrium, because you can't. So
yeah, I think that's right as well.
To be a distraction. Basically, everything is socially mediated, including your experience in life. And sure, you should try and like change some obviously bad traditions, but like for anyone that requires like galaxy brain rationalization like that, I think just like 99.9% of people are going to be fine with saying like, let's continue to value our families. And you know, there's excellent reasons for doing that. You have way more information about the people closest to you, etc. But like, and it incentivizes people to have children, which perpetuates our civilization. And even like, I think as Benny says, like, a lot, I take your point, Cam, but I think most of these are actually fairly uncontroversial. Even the euthanasia thing, I know that I don't hold it to be a sacred value, because I do support legal euthanasia, and I still find this particular depiction of it disgusting or like upsetting in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of like on Jed's side or on Welbeck's side. So I know that can't be a sacred value thing. It's just that it's,
I mean, euthanasia is a classic example of like, it is the sacred value, death and suicide.
I'm saying that it's not in this instance. Like, you could plausibly support euthanasia in principle and still object to the commercialization, you know, death as a service, revolving door.
That sounds like you're trying to, you legalize it, but you're trying to keep the sacredness around it.
Well, you just, no, it's not sacred. It's not about being sacred. It's about making sure that you don't start optimizing for the wrong thing. So there should be a high barrier to be euthanized. It shouldn't be done for profit because of this corrupting structure. Leading cause of death in Canada.
So New Zealand's implementing it, right? Like,
We have it.
Is ours as liberal as Canada's, or
Canada's actually isn't very liberal. Surprisingly,
why is there so many memes about Canada?
I honestly don't know, but the Canadian system's it's quite hard, and it's got a bit of a chicken and egg problem. So there's this problem where if you're deemed to be at all not in your right mind, so say you have like dementia or something, even if when you're lucid you clearly express a preference for wanting to be euthanized, then they won't take your word for it. You can't do it because you have to be like 100% of sound mind and body. Obviously, the difficulty is that when people are 100% of sound mind and body, they're typically don't want to be euthanized, because that typically means they have a good life, right? And so at that point, they're not ready for it to happen. So there's this weird problem where you have to sort of
kind
be
of
able to foresee few months in advance, like how my life's going to be, and then say, I want this to be done. But that's very hard for most people to do because you often don't see deterioration of health coming around the corner, right? So a lot of people find themselves in this situation where, for instance, that their parents, it's clear, like they know that their parents would have wanted in that situation to die, but now they can't do it because they can't get the person to sign off on it because they're deemed to be too sick already. So can't, the Canadian system is actually kind of hard to navigate, and I would say as much to risk averse with respect to it. I understand there's reasons why you want to be somewhat risk averse, and that's an interesting line to try and draw, but I think Canada's different.
Yeah, no, so that's how the question. Place. I mean, one of my most underrated, Scott Alexander, he says, I think, who by slow decay around just, how bad it is to die in our current system that gets prolonged for years.
Yeah, it sounds fucking horrible. Yeah.
So I agree with you, Rich, that I'm kind of pro it. But it does feel a bit icky sometimes in the excesses.
So, okay, so here's a question for you, Rich, which is that on your reading of the book, it seems like it would have been in keeping with those themes if the murder had never been solved. So if Ulbeck had just been killed and that was that, and then Jaslyn never figured out, or the police department never figured out who did it, no one would have had closure, right? In some sense, this would have just tied in with the fact that everyone is,
well, I suppose, sort of like the fact that got solved but it was like random kind of does fit. It was like, yeah, this is also meaningless,
yeah,
and random, and well, it's kind of like, yeah, it being unsolved, and there's no random meaning here. There's just some psychopath who collects art.
That's interesting.
Who,
yeah,
no, it's not quite that
tanned rich man. It was a funny physiognomy.
yeah,
throw away.
That was some weird trick.
Which I think was interesting actually to think about the different types of evil. But yeah, you go, Rich.
Well, it's not quite the randomness of it. It's designed to foil Inspector Yaseline's expectations or hopes. He says it's always about money. It's always about the money. And then when Jed identifies the painting is missing, he's like, okay, the case is solved. It's about the money. So on the one hand, he's happy, but in the back of his mind, he's thinking, in my entire career in the police, I've had the number of cases I could count on the fingers of one hand, which weren't about money or sex and for sexual crimes. And then when it's discovered that it's simply, when he gets the closure in some sense, he doesn't feel good. He feels depressed, and his exact thought process is like, I ought to feel good that this is sort of affirmation that there are very few purely evil beings in the world who do these things just for the thrill of it. Instead, they're motivated by money. But nevertheless, he feels sad because he wanted it to be different this one time. He wanted there to be like a creative spark or some kind of perverse passion or something. I got to confess, I'm a little confused about this because in my mind, there's something that I'm missing about the murderer, the fact that he does these almost artistic creations, and perhaps he is motivated by something other than money.
Sort of unexplained there. Yeah.
Like, did he kill? Like, okay.
I feel it was a bit
that way. He could have just killed Welbeck and stolen the painting. The ritualistic display is clearly his own art form or his own self expression. So what? I'm not clear on that. Like,
they definitely planted the Jason Pollock. But I mean, maybe in other senses, it's calling out Jackson Pollock's paintings, and the guy's just kind of a psychopath torturer because he had that stuff in his basement, right? Like, he had a bunch of
Jackson Pollock did.
Dismembered. Oh no.
maybe. I was like, probably.
But the murderer. Because he had the paintings in the four corners and then like dismembered body parts and stuff. Am I remembering correctly?
He had a Francis Bacon, he had a Jed's Welbeck portrait, and he had two of those plastinated corpse things from that crazy Dutch scientist or whoever, German guy.
Mm.
I mean, just to go back on your comment about the impotent dog, I also like when Welbeck died, how his dog got decapitated as well. I mean, I always think of that. The first rule of the movies is to make you hate someone. Just get them to kill their dog. Kill someone's dog. You almost like that just adds, you know, Welbeck's been absolutely hacked to pieces, and you're like, and the dog. I kind of liked, you just reminded me of
There's a couple of comments in two places around the predictability and boringness of like all crime or almost all crime, it sounds like. And when they were talking about economics as a sign, and she doesn't even, well, they didn't talk about poverty. Did you see poverty? I felt like the Leo.
Yeah. That was
meme,
funny.
Eh? Like,
yeah.
But she talked about how it doesn't even verify anything. This off comment of,
yeah, that was hilarious. Yeah.
But then showing
how did
that
feel to read, Benny?
Well,
yeah. So I was like, say more.
Welbeck is erudite.
Yeah.
But then they go on to. So someone makes some comment about all criminals, like they're very predictable in their behavior. And then there was another comment, I suppose that fits the same theme around, I think it was Jessalyn, who doesn't enjoy detective novels, and then he finally read some novelists, somewhat biographical novels in Thailand, and he liked the short story collection because They're all the same. They're all like the exactly same. And like, this felt, I mean, going back to Map and Territory, is like, this felt realistic. The reason he liked about it is because it captured realism. Yeah, and I think, I don't know, it's kind of this empirical question, I suppose, of how true it is that a lot of crime is very similar and very boring. And it's kind of a sad fact about the world. It goes a little bit against the kind of Deutschian creativity that you maybe expect a bit more.
Right.
Creativity and within crime as well.
So does the murderer fit the pattern or violate the pattern? That's what I can't figure out.
I think it definitely fits your theory of entropy, the pattern of entropy eroding. I think in terms of the pattern of all crime is boring and predictable. I mean, this one, I think serial killers as well as a phenomenon feels like counterexamples. And this guy is like this genuine psychopath. He's not a serial killer, maybe, but I think that probably, I don't know.
But in some way, he interestingly was not, like, he was not subject to the same sort of corruption pressures that a lot of people were, right? So he had this like $12 million painting in his house. He was obviously keeping the painting for the sake of the painting. And not trying to sell it. Like, he wasn't just trying to make a bunch of money because.
The surgeon or Welbeck?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the surgeon.
Well, both, but the surgeon, yeah.
The only way I could think of to maintain, like, the overall pattern is that the surgeon is a representation of the creative spirit, but he is, like, the grotesque, inverse version of it. And then the reason he's able to do that, like, how did he get so wealthy? Well, he's a cosmetic surgeon. He literally is like this, as you said, Cam, he's like this beautiful, handsome, tanned surgeon from Cannes who, like, presumably makes his money by exploiting people's.
It's almost like this was
self image. And,
you know, everyone who likes Welbeck likes BAP. That was BAP. And BAP's BAP. Bronze Age Perfect.
Yeah.
Just all the dismembered bodies in his basement.
He's enriched himself by feeding off people's fear of aging and death in some sense. And that's what allows him to pursue his fucked up passion projects and like live an artistically like unencumbered life of
just on
making
like
tarantulas fight against centipedes and stuff.
Yeah,
that was kind of yuck as well. awesome. it's funny because I heard about Welbeck being like shock value and stuff in a lot of his early books, and I was like, oh, this doesn't really have it. And then you get to the third act, and it's just like, it's been brutalized. Really, there's a comment around like one of the women, I can't remember whose wife had like fake breasts,
and Helene like, has fake breasts,
and it extends the sex life and doesn't, but like. Yeah, it just going back to the commoditizing things and commoditizing the sacred, and like in one sense is like a good thing. and then he kind of, I think he had another comment in the very old age, it kind of looks like it doesn't fit.
Yeah, and he says at that point you don't care because you're more worried about like coronary bypasses and tracheotomies and
at least your saggy,
weird plastic tits are like the least of your concern.
Yeah. What do we think? What do we think the title's about? The end. Is it like it seems like we're leaning more towards something like expectations versus reality, which is like sort of what the map and territory is not is getting at, but not quite.
Well, I think one of the big things is like, can you model the reality? And like, is it a worthwhile goal to do that, either like epistemologically or scientifically? In this sense, it's like artistically representing it, perhaps being sort of the same thing. Like, that's Jed's main goal in life. And I don't know. I don't
I
really
don't
know if the
know.
book makes the claim if like it's quixotic or is successful. And this book itself, in a meta sense, like perhaps is its goal as well. And then, but yeah, you don't quite think that's.
Yeah, in terms of whether that's Jed's goal, I mean, I agree, his. Especially his paintings, we're trying to model some part of the actual like, production
I think that's almost said it near
pipeline.
the end, right? Like that was what his artistic purpose was. Well, I mean, the other thing to be an artist was be submissive, right?
Yeah.
To is it be submissive just to creating art, really?
Yeah, it
And
seemed
whether
like
that
be
means
submissive to
destroying it,
impulse, in
yeah,
some
to be
sense.
submissive, yeah. Which feels true about artists that they do it. And so, I'm not sure how good it is to be submissive to all your impulses.
Yeah, I think we first have to circle back to your original question, Benny, which is like, has Jed escaped from this failure mode that everyone else is falling into? Like, is he the counterexample to most of to every single other character? And I think there's like a pretty good case that he is because he never sells out. He becomes filthy rich, but he doesn't fall into decadence. He uses his money in like an insane artist way. Which is in keeping with his service to the muse, right? Like he moves home to his grandparents' house, and then he buys like 500 hectares of surrounding land and fences it all off and becomes like a crazy eccentric artist. And then I think he dedicates like 30 years, his final 30 years of life, to making his artistic project. So he doesn't care about
I don't know,
commercialization.
it's kind of weird.
About cashing in, he's not driven by like mortal timelines or like
His
capitalistic
status. He's not driven by status
timelines.
or popularity.
Like who takes 30 years to work on something? Only a true artist, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't hurt that he's filthy rich, but I mean, like his life from my point of view is extremely alien and not something I would want for myself, but. From his point of view, I think he succeeds on his own terms. He not only like resists these corrupting forces and stays true to the muse, but he also his final project is basically like capturing exactly this, like capturing the struggle
Yeah, but would you say
portraying.
his muse is trying to map reality, right? Like that seemed to be what his like raison d'être was.
I don't even know if it matters. Like, we could talk about that, but I don't even know if it matters. The main thing is that he does what his artistic impulses tell him to do. We could sort of argue about what those impulses are, but like, he's not trying to do what the market wants, put it that way. Like, he lives in squalor pretty much his whole life. He doesn't chase women. He doesn't become
As
too.
a slight side point around his paintings, like his series, like I was kind of re-flicking through it. Like, I think it was a brilliant idea from Welbeck, the author of like the series of paintings of around the series of professions, and like the first ones being ones that are dying, and another one, and then like culminating in Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and and Damien Hirst and Jeff Koons. And I was really trying to like, I was kind of imagining these paintings, and I was like, yeah, I could really see it. I could really see these being like an awesome series, and if done well. And it was, yeah, I think it was quite yeah, sort of spark of insight of Welbeck to have that.
I would love to
I
have
wonder if
lunch
there
with
are.
Welbeck. I wonder, like,
I don't
after.
know. Maybe I'm not sure if
Yeah,
he'd be the funnest company.
He'd be interesting, though.
Yeah, he would be. I remember Tyler Cowen the one time saying, like, whose people you'd like to have on that, like, you struggle to get on. And it's just Welbeck, because I think Welbeck's English is like pretty
It's
shit.
just not good enough, yeah. You should have a translator, fuck it. It could be worth it.
Yeah. I listened to like the first minute or two of he was on the Red Scare podcast.
Oh, did they get him on? Because I know
What's
they're
he really?
fucking, yeah, I know they're
Do
fawn over
they
him.
speak French?
No, and they did have a translator, and it was just so awkward. It was awkward enough that I just felt cringe and I just turned it off. It might be
Oh,
worth
really?
persevering
Didn't
with.
really work.
Oh, I don't know.
Especially like
I
their
didn't
whole
really give it a
shtick is
fair
like
shake, but
comedy and not caring and reverence and like, and then you
I'm
just
just,
lose
yeah.
that in translation.
I don't
Lose
have
all of it.
much patience with them, so.
Oh, you gone off them?
I mean, I never really liked them, but
Cute girls that are funny. I've never seen a tweet, I think, summed it up as like essentially like they're so polarizing. People think they're idiots and people think they're genius. And this guy was just like, I just think the reason is like they're kind of funny, and that's why people like them. Yeah, I think they sort of say you don't really know the language until you can kind of joke in it. And I always imagine like someone like Infinite Jest, like the idea of translations. Like, imagine trying to translate Infinite
Oh
Jest. Just
man.
feels. I mean, maybe you could do it. Maybe it would be fine. I can imagine Dave Oswald is getting a bit neurotic around that.
Yeah.
Seeing like the Chinese version and just thinking like, "Fuck, is this capturing it or what?"
You really have to trust the translators. I mean, really, at that point, the translators are becoming authors in some sense, right? Like, I
Yeah.
think for Brothers K that we or that you guys read, I guess. Larissa Gorievsky and Richard Pevear.
Well,
I
Richard
basically view
Red
them.
Garnett, I think. By
Sorry?
the way. Richard Red, the original Garnett guy.
Oh, interesting.
The classic.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm just gonna do something. I'll be with you guys in
Right.
a sec.
Take your time, mate. Take
But just like the
your time.
very fact that the translations are different sort of implies that the translators are now taking on part of the role of the author,
Yeah, I think that's true about translation. It's funny though. It's kind of getting back into map and territory as well. Like, there does feel like this kind of territory there though of the original text. And like, sometimes I look at different translations side by side, and it's like, yeah, they're a bit different. And like, every now and then you get like a big difference. But a lot of the time it's like, oh wow, like
right?
this
Yeah, 100%,
really
yeah. Right,
is, you're kind of constrained into like whatever the sentence was.
true.
You sort of translate it, and then they're often very similar. And like, reworded a little bit that, more than Claudine Gay or something, but like they are kind of the almost isomorphic a lot of the time. I think in Brothers K example, one of the examples is like there's a chapter called Strains, and another translation was called Lacerations, and it's like, and it's metaphorically talking about strains on like the soul, and it's
Actually,
like,
the
I think there's a Russian word that's quite specific of what it is, and like you don't have perfect.
yeah, I see. Yeah.
I think the enduring impression I have of Welbeck after this book, and the reason why I do really like this book, is that he simply does not give a fuck. I do not believe he cares
He's
about what
sort of
people
reached
think.
enlightenment, hasn't he? Yeah.
I think so, and I don't think it's some meta counter-signaling thing where he like portrays himself as a dweeb to ironically signal how cool and self-deprecating he is. I think he is honest, he is like pursuing his honest creative vision, including like introducing a murder mystery
He
in the
is
third
Jed.
act, and like he obviously he knows that that's not how that's like in violation of genre conventions, and he doesn't care. It's not that he holds the reader in contempt either. It's just I don't think he's too
You're right
interested.
though, and it's a pretty big thing of praise. I mean, I always talk about Wallace, but I remember Wallace talking about David Lynch and being this like light bulb moment when he went and watched Blue Velvet, I think. In the 90s with some friends, and he just like the Lynch was just doing all these avant-garde, I suppose, but just original things that were subversive, and it just unlocked him, and he's like, you as an artist, you can just do this things.
Yeah.
And Welbeck does, and he doesn't care at all.
It makes me think about how hard it must be to impose your vision upon the world. Like, this is the thing that we value, right, amongst artists. It must be really hard in any collaborative type situation, like making a film, for instance, which is why you have these directors.
Well, they're always known as dictators.
Fucking tyrants.
Yeah.
It's not a coincidence, I think. Maybe you don't get Kubrick films without Kubrick being like.
Well, that is one of the interesting differences about the medium of like a book and is quite, and a painting probably as well, you know. As an artist, is completely in your control.
A book is not because your publisher will fuck it up.
Yeah, true. More so, but yeah, not completely. And then there's other mediums which are very collaborative, and yeah, and you hear all these stories of director tyrants.
I think I heard the Red Scare Girls or someone say that, like, why are there so many great male artists in history, or why are there so few great female artists? And obviously there's a ton of historical reasons for that, like context for that. But part of it might be that men are more disagreeable and are willing to, and anything that involves any kind of collaboration, an editor, a collaborator, you have to impose your singular vision upon the world and not compromise on it. And men are, on aggregate, at population level, better at doing that.
Yeah.
And it's obviously like higher variance. So you get a whole lot of like total shit as well, where it would have been way
yeah,
better.
Yeah. So you get the greater variance.
To outside opinions. And, yeah. I think of Kanye like that as well, like produces some of the greatest work and the most completely and stupid, insane work.
Yeah. And the big confounder, of course, with him with mental illness. I mean, the hard thing with someone like Kanye, who when he becomes mentally ill, is like he's got these delusions of grandeur, but like it must be so hard to snap out of it, because like he's got a claim to be the best artist alive, the best musician alive, right? Is he's got a non-crazy claim to make that. And he's like, well, fuck you guys. Like, you guys don't understand. Like, don't try to tell Steve Jobs what to do.
Yeah.
He was also a crazy dickhead. Like, he was right, you guys are wrong.
Yeah.
and who he obviously is genuinely mentally ill, but like it's much harder for him to get, like, his delusions of grandeur are somewhat substantiated, right? And then
also, I mean, his history is basically one of people telling him he wasn't gonna be good at what he tried to do, like, you know, music producers early on were,
and
like,
he knew,
you know,
better,
like, don't become a rapper, and he just did it and then became the best. And then same with his whole like clothing branding stuff. They were like, no, we know what we're doing, like, this is a terrible idea, other musicians have tried to do this, and then he succeeded at that too. And so he's got this history of people telling him he can't do something and then just fucking blowing it out of the water. And so you can see from his perspective why he would just totally stop to take like criticism seriously in some sense. He's like, fuck you, like, I've seen this,
yeah, where's
I've
your
seen
time
this party
cover
before, and,
like, yeah,
and I,
yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Like,
and
I, like, there is a kernel of truth there as well, and you can go too far with it and turn it into an anti-rational meme. But the other interesting thing about Kanye as a case study is this idea of like musical genius and artistic genius, and like, is Jed a genius, and is Kanye a genius? And then it's like, you hear Kanye talk on Lex Fridman, whatever, and you're like, this guy would sound like an idiot on a discussion with us right now. Some of the shit he's saying, like, he's just like, he's not following the link sometimes, and he's going off. And it's like, this guy's obviously not a genius. But then his music is, I mean, you can have arguments, but let's just grant that his music is amazing, which I agree with. And we couldn't do that. And it feels right to call it genius, but like it's kind of feels different in some sense. Like there's a qualitatively different thing going on, perhaps, but maybe not as well. It's just like there's this creative spark, and it's like a kind of, it is a qualitatively different output, but like, you know.
Well, I think it's pretty common though for quote unquote geniuses to not be geniuses in all areas. Right, it's unlike intelligence in that way, where you typically, if you're smarter than average, typically that's correlated, and typically you're smarter than average in most areas. So it's very rare to be extremely good at math, for instance, or extremely good at writing, and be extremely bad at the other one. just because G seems to be like a
pretty good like one. Often we
the
call
genius seems to be the sorry, go ahead.
People that are just high intelligence as genius. Like you call Einstein a genius, or you call Shakespeare a genius, and like across the board, or like Borges is a genius, and like they're like they'd be very smart and insightful across the board. And then sometimes, I mean, Wallace used to sometimes call athletes a genius, and then that there you're kind of like, oh, maybe not, and like metaphorically maybe, or like, but you're talking about a different thing there perhaps. And then sometimes I think that with like music and painting, it's like
it's got to be
they
like
truly are
the
best
type two and type one geniuses, right? Like instinctive, heuristic driven, intuitive fields versus like highly explicit, like formal thinking.
Sorry, I said Shakespeare. Lovely. I should have said Richard Hanania. Literary genius.
SBF would be pissed, dude.
Yeah.
Kanye, the Kanye example is like, it's too muddied by the mental illness thing, because I think for a lot of his career, he should have ignored the critics and stayed true to his vision. But then like right now, he should listen to the people telling him to like get back on his meds and like, you know, like sort
of. Do you know though, I wonder, because his shit is like so deranged, right? Or like, or maybe it's as deranged as, you know, fucking Jed might be or Welbeck, but the reason we have a different view of it is like, it's how harmful it might be when you get into racism and stuff. And but I sometimes I wonder, like, if it was less harmful and he was just chimping out about some crazy shit and still producing art,
Everyone
would just be like, oh, fuck it. He's just a crazy
like
genius.
UFOs.
And like
UFOs.
Yeah, some, like, harmless shit. And
he's been acting erratic for fucking ages, but he was releasing incredible albums.
Like,
so, yeah, no, nah, the proof of the pudding
well,
is
I mean,
the,
even in the greatest video of all time, right? This is like 07, 08 is like the big moment. Taylor Swift.
Yeah, exactly. So
he made her famous. you kind of wonder about his medical history of like, when did he start going on meds? When did he go off them? Did they hamper his creativity or not at times?
To be fair, I actually think a lot of Donda was really good. But when did that come out?
That was like, must have been like 2016 or something, right?
It was more recent than that. It was like 2 years ago.
I mean, to my shame, I don't really listen to new music anymore.
It was 2021. You know, no way.
It was recent.
Yeah, it was good actually. So maybe he should just stay off his meds.
The problem now, though, is like there's so much baggage with Kanye that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting though, if he truly made a transcendent, truly great.
Yeah.
Music, but people would probably begrudgingly say, yeah, Dylan was pretty good.
Yeah. An interesting conflict I'm realizing is the one between being open to criticism and imposing your singular vision on something. And that even comes up, I think, in microcosm, even if you're just writing an essay. So often you have like a particular angle or style that you think is good. You get some feedback. People are like, this doesn't make any sense. And then you have to figure out, okay, like, do I listen to them? You know, do I just publish the sucker? Like, and typically I err on the side of really being extremely open to criticism. And like someone tells me something, you know,
maybe
I can
you're
change
too
something
open.
This doesn't,
I've
doesn't
heard
make
some
sense.
Advice that, yeah, it can be bad if you're like too willing to
like too
maybe hear it from a few people and then two different people were saying the same thing. I mean, it depends how much you trust someone as well.
Yeah, does. But there is an interesting thing there, right? Like, would we have truly, probably most people, like the median person should be probably more open to criticism. But if everyone was extremely open to criticism, would you have sort of moonshot artists that just did their thing that most people thought at the beginning wouldn't work out and it just worked out? I don't know.
Yeah, this is how you get like the 100% Rotten Tomatoes thing, right? Like designed by a committee, inoffensive slop.
Exactly.
I think it doesn't work. It's like domain specific. For questions of fact, criticism is always useful and always should be listened to. But for questions of taste, like first you have to know who your audience is that you want to resonate with and then get their opinions. And then for the greatest artists of all, your audience is one person, yourself. You only care about making art that you yourself like, and therefore you don't need to solicit any opinion because you've got the ear for it, you've got the eye for it.
But to write an essay kind of or a book kind of blurs it of like, is this just taste? And sometimes it is. It's like, yeah, I prefer writing it like this. And you know,
but there's also objectively cool. better.
But sometimes it's like, yeah, this is like, this is not clear here.
Yeah, you might have. Way. Yeah, for sure.
I disagree with this. This seems wrong. And then as the writer, you're kind of like, I'm not sure if I agree with that, and I'm going to ignore the criticism. And sometimes it might be good to ignore the criticism. I mean, hopefully you should maybe understand the criticism and be able to point to why you disagree with it, and then it might be a
values
or context.
Acknowledge
like,
it.
I fucking hate it with my boss sometimes. Or like even just products and work. I'm like, I point to improvements, and then or he'll want it a certain way, and I'm like, give me a reason at least, or at least just say like, I just want it this way because like, sorry, but like there's like no reason with it. I'm like, I'm giving you this reason, give me a response why my reason's wrong. I'm like, I'm just improving this for the audience, and it might be wrong, but like I hate not getting a reason.